Welcome to part two of our two-part episode on John the Fisherman. In part one, we began with the question, who was this son of thunder who stood at the foot of the cross so passively when we should have expected him to behave very differently? What I mean is this. If you consider what was happening at the crucifixion in simple human terms, that your beloved teacher, master, and friend, who was popular throughout the whole land for his teachings and miracles, had suddenly been put on trial and convicted for being an enemy of the state and the Jewish people, when you knew it was a bogus setup by evil people who were jealous of him, wouldn't you, as an average person, go into a wild rage? But what if you were prone to wild rages already, as we might presume someone was who was nicknamed a Son of Thunder? Don't you think he, most certainly, would have gone uncorked about the whole thing and have brought down as many people as he could with as many swings and stabs he had in him? But he didn't. Why not? I want to know. Let's keep fleshing John out. Let's see where and how he was raised, how he worked, and why his work might, just might, have made him absolutely perfectly suited to do exactly what Jesus asked him to do. It's all really quite stunning and informative, and fills in a lot of blanks about him we might otherwise have. Let's go to Bethsaida for a minute. Why Bethsaida? Well, because of the passages from the New Testament, which require some piecing together. In Mark, Jesus goes to Galilee and finds Philip, and he tells Philip to follow him. And it says, Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. This means we know that Peter, Andrew, and Philip were all from Bethsaida. So hang on. Then in Matthew, we hear that Jesus sees both Peter and Andrew and tells them to follow him too. And it continues by saying that, going on from there, he saw two other brothers, James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, in the boat with Zebedee, their father. But the passage doesn't say where they are, and it never mentions Bethsaida. It only says this happened as Jesus walked by the Sea of Galilee. So all we know is that Peter and Andrew are nearby Zebedee, James, and John. But then we get to Luke chapter 5, and we get this interesting detail. It relates how Peter was fishing and hadn't caught anything all night until Jesus told him to put out into the deep and let down his nets for catch. And when he did, they caught such a high catch that their nets were breaking, so that they, and here are the words to notice, signaled to their partners in the other boat. Their partners. The Greek word is metikois, which means partner in the business sense. They're business partners. And the passage says how not only Peter was astonished at the catch, but so also were James and John, sons of Zebedee, Simon's partners. That word, partners, appears twice in that passage. So, readers, since the early Christians have been willing to assume that, number one, since Peter was from Bethsaida, and number two, that Peter was a business partner with Zebedee, James, and John, then, ergo, number three, Zebedee, James, and John were also from Bethsaida. Peter, by the way, also had a house in Capernaum, about 6 miles south and west down the lake. In fact, it was there that Andrew, James, and John went into it and found Peter's mother-in-law sick with a fever. So, did Peter have two houses? One in Capernaum, one in Bethsaida? Did he move to Bethsaida and leave his mother-in-law in the granny flat back in Capernaum? Well, we just don't know. So, what do we know about Bethsaida? Well, here we do have a lot of unknowns. Wherever Bethsaida was, it was expressly mentioned in two other gospel passages. First, it was where Jesus healed a blind man. And second, it was where, or near where, Jesus fed the 5,000 with five loaves and two fish. Was that tilapia or bini? The passage doesn't say. But it does say they were in a deserted place, and the apostles told Jesus that he should disperse the crowds so they could go into the villages and country round about to lodge and get provision. Andrew, You said there was a kid around here with some bread and fish? Go get him. Now, the name Bethsaida is the Greek and Romanized version of the Aramaic and Hebrew Bethsaida, which means literally either the house of the fisherman or the house of the hunter. You'd think archaeology and history would be able to tell us where exactly Bethsaida really was, but no, they don't. Pretty much everyone accepts that it was located on the northern shore of Lake Galilee, near where the River Jordan runs into the lake. Some have said this was a perfect fishing location at the time, because underground springs in the vicinity kept the water warmer, and fish tended to congregate more there. But two sites vie for the honor of being the biblical Bethsaida. At one point, three sites were in contention, but they've since ruled out one of those. And maybe in a few years, they'll actually nail down the place between the remaining two. The leading location is at a place known as Et Tel. It's got a number of factors in its favor. First, they've dug up two houses from the period. One is called the winemaker's house because they found a wine cellar with four large wine jars in it. The other is called the fisherman's house because they found lead net weights, anchors, and fish hooks in it, which is what you'd expect to find in a village named House of Fish. And they also found some Herodian oil lamps and limestone vessels, which you'd expect to find in a Jewish house. They also found something like a temple to honor Julia Livia, wife of Caesar Augustus. In fact, this and some other evidence has led scholars to think that Josephus was wrong when he said that Herod Philip had renamed Bethsaida after the daughter of Augustus Caesar. Josephus was known to make mistakes from time to time. He wasn't divinely inspired after all. But there are admitted problems with thinking that this site was Bethsaida, notwithstanding that the Israeli government has declared it to be so. The biggest problem is it's more than a mile away from the shoreline. That's a long way for a place like that to be a fishing village. It's also about 20 feet higher than the level of the lake. The counterpoints are that, well, perhaps tectonic plates have moved and elevated the site over time, or that water level has dropped as population and usage have increased, a fact apparently proven by excavation of the harbor at Magdala on the west side of the lake, or that creeping sedimentation of the Jordan River has extended the land around it. The other candidate for the ancient polis of Bethsaida is El Araj. This is actually south of Et Tel and is only a couple hundred yards from the lake. And they found a lot more pottery, coins, mosaics, and other things that date to the exact time period. Plus, there was the account of a bishop from Bavaria, Bishop Willibald, who visited the area in 724 AD while on a pilgrimage. And he said he spent the night in a place where there was a Byzantine church that locals told him was built over the home of St. Peter, which was there and not at Capernaum. Well, in just 2019, just a few years ago, guess what archaeologists found right in that area of El Araj? Yes, the remains of a Byzantine church. And what makes the location also tantalizing is there are numerous plains and hills in the surrounding area which could hold large numbers of people, say like 5,000 people who were there to listen to Jesus preach and to stuff themselves with bread and fish, courtesy of the divine multiplier. The archaeologists are being cautious. Don't jump to any conclusions, folks, is what they say. But what's fascinating is that even within our own modern times, we come a bit closer to knowing more about the places where Jesus walked and talked, and where John walked, too. I know it would be nice to think of Bethsaida as a quaint little fishing village where all was well and good. Well, Jesus didn't think so. He did mighty works there, and no one repented. Three cities he mentioned for special condemnation: Chorazin, Bethsaida, and the place where he stayed, another town also on the edge of the lake, Capernaum. Take this passage in from Matthew chapter 11. Then he began to upbraid the cities where most of his mighty works had been done, because they did not repent. Woe to you, Chorazin! Woe to you, Bethsaida! For if the mighty works done in you had been done in Tyre and Sidon, they would have repented long ago in sackcloth and ashes. But I tell you, it shall be more tolerable on the day of judgment for Tyre and Sidon than for you. And you, Capernaum, will you be exalted to heaven? You shall be brought down to Hades. For if the mighty works done in you had been done in Sodom, it would have remained until this day. But I tell you that it shall be more tolerable on the day of judgment for the land of Sodom than for you. So, in the end, what are we to think about the place where John was likely born and raised? Well, it was a fishing village. Beyond that, at least right now, we'd have to agree with Father Meyer, quote, next to nothing. Was it a hellhole because Jesus cursed it and said that those wonderful people who lived in Sodom and Gomorrah would be better off than they would be? Probably. What kind of hellhole? Hard to say. Hellholes, to paraphrase what Tolstoy said in War and Peace about unhappy families, are each hellholes in their own way. Maybe this is what made Peter and Andrew and James and John so especially good, and why they might have been especially eager to get up and follow Jesus at his least word and get away from that special hellhole they all lived in. Let's go into that quaint little village that may have been a hellhole to talk for a bit about the cultural life that John grew up in and how he grew up. His parents were Zebedee and Salome. Zebedee appears twice in the Gospels, in Matthew and in Mark, where he's left in the boat to watch his boys follow Jesus. His name is mentioned in Matthew's Passion narrative, where we hear, standing at the foot of the cross, is, quote, the mother of Zebedee's children. The name Zebedee does not appear in the Greek, and the Hebrew meaning is closely related to Zebediah, which means Yahweh has given, or Yahweh has bestowed. Quite prophetic. Yahweh gives us Zebedee, so Zebedee can give sons, James and John, back to him. The mother of his children is someone we believe is named Salome, and we talked to her about her quite a bit in episode 11. We don't know her name for certain, but it seems plausible she's the same person who's cross-referenced in the crucifixion accounts in Matthew and Mark. James appears to have been older than John because he is usually named before him in the gospel list, and that was one of the indications that writers of the time gave to indicate birth order. I say usually because on four occasions, Luke names John before James, which has caused pesky scholars to jump in and say, we don't know James was older than John. Whatever. The fact is that when they are first introduced, even when Luke first introduces them, they're introduced in the order of James and then John, which suggests that James is older. And when Luke later introduces them and changes the order of their names, arguably because John plays a greater role in his gospel than does James, and so readers will orient themselves faster by hearing John's name first. Now, assuming James was born first, which I think we're permitted to infer, then James would have been the Bechor, the special word in Hebrew for the firstborn son. This was the word Luke used to describe Mary's son, Jesus, the Bechor. A son necessarily bore his father's name, son of so-and-so, Ben in Hebrew, Bar in Aramaic. The eldest son was often given his grandfather's name to carry on the family tradition and to distinguish him from his father. James would have likely been the name of Zebedee's father. Now, we Anglos say James, but Iakobos would have been how they said it. Iakobos being the Greek derivative of Jacob, which was a common name because of the great patriarch of their people. James, the son of Zebedee, would have been known in Hebrew as Iakobos ben Zebedee, and in Aramaic as Iakobos bar Zebedee. Now, the name John comes from the Hebrew Yochanan, which means God has been gracious. Again, how prophetic. God was most gracious in giving this John to the world so he could proclaim the light to the world. Like Iakobos, Yochanan was a common enough name. Four other persons in the New Testament are named John. We have the Baptist. We have the father of Peter. Remember, he was Simon bar Jonah. And then there's a John Mark we hear about. And finally, there's a John who's mentioned in the Acts of the Apostles as a relative of Annas, the high priest. Names were often given to describe the circumstance of birth. Zebedee and Salome may have been thankful to God for having given them a second son, and they named him God Has Been Gracious, or John, because of it. We don't hear about any other siblings, so maybe they had problems having children. Maybe. Thankfully, we can conclude he was not born from some other Jewish mother whose child naming has come down to us in history. Apparently, this woman bore nothing but daughters. When her fourth came, she named her Zeole, which means the nuisance. And when her eighth came, she named her Tamam, which means that is enough. I would like to bet that Tamam grew up to be a great Christian saint. Her older sister, Zeole, not so much. Yes, another good campfire story. The law required every male to be circumcised, and by the time of Jesus, it was to be done on the eighth day after birth. The timing was so deliberate that it would even supersede the restrictions of the Sabbath. I think we can safely assume that James and John would have gone through this ritual on the eighth day after they were born, too. One common fact of Jewish cultural life was that a father would look after his sons and teach them his trade as soon as possible so he could make them his apprentices and journeymen. We see this in the parable of the man with two sons who sends them out to the vineyard and work it, or in the parable of the prodigal son, where one son stayed to work with his father while the other son asked for a share so he could spend it on prostitutes and high living. It was an accepted part of life that fathers and sons worked together. The father's first duty was to teach his children the commandments. As Moses said, "You shall teach your children my commandments." Fathers told their children all the wonders that God had done for their people, the meaning of all the feasts they celebrated, and how each of their customs had deep religious significance. The Feast of Unleavened Bread, for example, was marked by God's command that they shall teach their children all that the Lord did in bringing them out of the slavery of Egypt. A custom, the account said, must be worn like a brand on the hand or a badge on one's forehead. At age 5, a child would begin with sacred studies. Each synagogue had a primary school connected with it where the children went to school. Their principal task was to repeat by rote, along with their master, the sentences he said out loud. Primarily, they learned the Torah. A saying was that a child should be fattened with the Torah as an ox is fattened in the stall. In other words, eat and eat and eat of it to the exclusion of everything else. The maxims of the law, learnt in childhood, go in the blood and come out at the lips. It was used to learn everything they considered worth learning. The alphabet, grammar, history, geography. If it wasn't in the Torah, it wasn't much worth learning because it wasn't about Yahweh. At age 10, the child would learn all the traditions. At age 13, he was expected to know the whole of the law of Yahweh and to practice its requirements. He'd be plenty sufficient to begin lifelong practices as an adult. He'd recite the all-important Shema 3 times a day. He would fast regularly and on the set days, such as at the Feast of Atonement. He would undertake the traditional pilgrimages and in Jerusalem be allowed into the court of men in the temple area. The roots of the bar mitzvah ceremony are unclear. The term never once appears in the Hebrew scriptures, but the term does appear in the Talmud, which appeared in about the year 175 to 200 AD, and it may or may not reflect actual practices in first century Palestine. And if it did, it said that boys at the age of 13 should be expected to fulfill the law, the mitzvot, which is how the term bar mitzvah arises. There's that word bar again, meaning son. The boy was expected to be a son of the law. Many boys stopped with their education at age 13, but those who pressed further would at age 15 be expected to come to the perfection of their knowledge. Now, all of this is pretty critical information that we need to know about Peter, Andrew, James, and John. It puts to lie those critics who insist they were illiterate fishermen who could never have written the works they wrote. They most certainly could have, because they had been trained in reading and writing, if not, as the saying goes, also arithmetic. In other words, we should presume, not dispute, that Peter was the author of both of his letters, and that John was the author of the works traditionally attributed to him. There is the insult that got hurled at Peter and John when they were hauled before Annas and Caiaphas and the other religious leaders in Jerusalem to account for how a miracle had appeared at their hands outside the temple area. The leaders were surprised and wondered at how such men were able to speak so well, even though they were uneducated. Now, some commentators have used this to show that Peter and John could never have written letters or a gospel. But other commentators have noted that prevailing prejudices about the locals in the north would not necessarily mean they were illiterate, but that they never received the kind of, well, proper education that they would have received in Jerusalem. Years ago, in this country, or at least one corner of the country, you would have heard the same thing. Why should I listen to anyone who is schooled, not never schooled at Harvard or Yale or Princeton? But let's continue. We cannot underestimate the importance of the family to Jewish life. It was the essential building stone of society. Flesh of my flesh and bone of my bone meant something. The family was not only the unit of society, it was the unit of the religious community. The Passover, for example, had to be celebrated as a family. The law was oriented to protecting the family. We see the power of this in the New Testament. When fathers converted and were baptized, the whole household converted and was baptized. Nepotism was regarded as a matter of right, which is why the office of the high priest was passed down from one family member to another when possible and without shame. The family unit was completely independent. Now, this was in sharp distinction to those societies built upon clans or chiefs. In Judaism, the father was the master, yes, a kind of king, but of his household. And his wife, to a similar extent, was the queen. She was exempt from many of the religious requirements, like reciting the Shema, wearing phylacteries, and so forth. But she was advised to know the law so she could ensure her sons and husband were fulfilling it. This family structure made for an extraordinary sense of equality among all Jews, at least all those outside the priestly class. I'm quoting from Henri Danreux Ross, a Catholic French author from the mid-20th century. He has a very nice book called Daily Life in the Time of Jesus. It came out in 1961 and has been eclipsed by additional history and archaeology since then, but it still stands up with some trenchant observations, including this. A Roman humilior meeting a wealthy patrician in his purple striped toga on his way to the Senate with all of his clients about him did not feel his equal. But the most wretched of the faithful, standing in the court of the temple with his arms raised towards heaven in prayer, knew that in the eyes of Yahweh he was as good as Herod. Yes, prayer. We need to talk about that. The synagogue was primarily a house of prayer. Secondarily, it governed the life of the members, appointed local magistrates, saw to the teaching of children, and constituted a kind of university for the locals. The word for a meeting or gathering in Hebrew was knesset, but the word in Greek was synagogue, and that's a word that is stuck essentially without translation. The concept seems to have begun in Babylon as a substitute for the temple. Ezra brought it back to Palestine when he returned. There were synagogues in Egypt in the 3rd century BC. Each village had its own, and each town had several. Associations of men in the same trade had their own, and we may wonder whether the fishermen along the rim of Lake Galilee may have had their own synagogues too. They were even in Jerusalem, some saying between 400 and 500 of them. They were typically situated as high as possible in their town or village. As the rabbi said, no man should live higher than the synagogue. But they were also set near a source of fresh water because of the ritual ablutions needed. The architecture was plain, a rectangular hall with columns dividing it into three aisles, and a supporting gallery or area for the women. There were three doors into it and a flight of steps in front. There was no altar, but a kind of cupboard shielded by a curtain, which covered the precious scrolls containing the law in a leather case wrapped in linen. Beside them were the horns and trumpets, which were used to proclaim the feasts and fasts. In front was a lamp, perpetually burning. There was a platform for the reader, who would face Jerusalem when reading. The congregation of men would sit on benches or stools, and they'd often vie to be in front. Before the service, it was common to sprinkle the floor with mint to help clear the air. The meetings were typically governed by a committee of 10 elders, and they would typically elect one to be the ruler of the synagogue, or sometimes three. According to Luke, Jairus was the one at Capernaum, and Jesus, as we will discuss in the next episode, raised his 12-year-old daughter from the dead. The leader and the council looked to the administration of the community, appointing school teachers, admitting proselytes, addressing finances, and resolving disputes. The services were simple. Three times a day, they would pray the Shema and the Shemona Esrei. The Shema, of course, is the most sacred of all prayers, beginning with, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one, and as for you, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength." Shemona Esrei is the Hebrew word for 18, and it refers to 18 praises and prayers said, except tradition has added an additional one, making the praises and prayers actually total 19. It's also called Amida, which means standing, and refers to these prayers and praises which are to be said standing. They prayed these prayers morning, noon, and evening. As evidence of this practice in the New Testament, we see Peter in the Acts of the Apostles when he was at Joppa, going on the housetop at noon to pray. And let me offer one huge caveat here. What we know about Jewish liturgy and prayer life is a lot more certain after the Talmud came to be in the late 2nd century, and a lot less certain before then. We've talked a lot about this in the Trial of Jesus episodes, because so much happened after the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, and it's very hard to know exactly what was done before that period, for Jewish and non-Jewish scholars alike. So we need to be sensitive to that. In fact, while the practice and form of the Amida and the 19 prayers that are said is a lot more certain after the Talmud, whether it existed in that same form before that period is not exactly known, and it may not have even included 19 prayers. It likely included fewer prayers. There's a lot of fascinating commentary on the Amida, for example, and in showing that the prayer Jesus told his disciples to pray, the Our Father, is really a summary or encapsulation of the Amida. We don't have time to go into that here, but I urge you to do so. It's really quite exquisite and profound. So, back to the prayer practices that we think we know about at the time of Jesus and John, but we're not exactly sure about. Let's just say these prayers and practices are plausible. I'm fine with that, if you are. Now, one would wrap himself in his tallit, his prayer shawl, and wear his tefillin. The tallit was a large kind of scarf, which when thrown over the head and shoulders came down to the waist, covering the whole upper part of the body. When possible, it was made of white silk, with a bunch of grapes or pomegranates embroidered on it in deep blue. Its edges had the ritual fringes, and at the corners, there was the tzitzit, the tassels, which had 8 threads apiece, so that there were 32 altogether, which was the numerical equivalent to the word heart. As for the tefillin, which are also known as phylacteries from the Greek, they were little square black cases made of the skin of clean animals, which contained passages from Exodus and Deuteronomy, written on parchment, and they were tied to the forehead and the palm of the hand with thongs. They would turn towards Jerusalem when they prayed, following the example of Daniel when in exile. If you were in Jerusalem, you'd turn towards the temple, as if you were in it, facing the Holy of Holies. At prayer, they would recite the Shema. It was the rhythm of the day. Then there would be requests for daily bread, spiritual grace, the forgiveness of sins, the restoration of Jerusalem, the reuniting of the tribes, and the advent of the kingdom of God. The Sabbath required at least 7 to officiate. The presence of at least 10 men was required before a service could begin, a minyan, as it was called. The service began with prayers with the congregants facing Jerusalem. After the Shema came the reading of the law. The whole of the Torah was read every 3 years. It was forbidden to read more than one verse by heart to ensure that the word would always control, even if the reader would have been expected to also know it by heart. An official stood at his hand, and if he made a mistake, he'd correct him. Each verse read in Hebrew was translated into Aramaic. Lectors were allowed to make commentary on the passage read. The length would vary according to the speaker. A reader might also read a lesson from one of the prophets. The final prayer ended with a blessing that some said had to be done in a single breath. Some synagogues had a tradition of singing one of the psalms at the end. The service lasted about an hour. On leaving the service, an alms collector would stand by to collect offerings for the poor. Often, the doorways were full of in-kind donations that people left for them. One can imagine the Zebedee family leaving a sheaf of dried or salted fish there regularly. You can't overstate the importance of the local synagogue. Everyone participated, not only in the services, but the administrative and judicial business of it. To be expelled was a deeply significant matter, and John notes how this happened when those who acknowledged Jesus as the Christ were forbidden in it. You'd be dead to the world, as you should be. You've turned your back on God. We shall turn our backs on you. The Sabbath was the token between God and man, in which man was ordered to refrain from work of any kind by resting from all labors, just as God himself had rested on the seventh day of creation. Moses decreed that anyone violating the Sabbath was to be punished upon death. It started at twilight on Friday. The women had already cooked the meals that were to be eaten. House was cleaned, for no housework was allowed on the day. She'd filled the Sabbath lamp with oil. She prepared the rounds of bread with fish, dates, and figs. Wine and herbs would be included, and a threefold blessing was invoked. And then, no eating until synagogue on Saturday morning. At the synagogue, they heard a passage of the Bible read and commented upon. They'd return home for their midday meal. If there was a house of learning, the rabbis and doctors would meet there in the afternoon to discuss theological questions. They'd eat dinner at about 5 p.m., but only after blessing the light, the wine, and the herbs three times. And then a trumpet would sound, giving sign that the Sabbath was over. They would rise, wash their hands, and offer thanks over a goblet of wine. It was to be a joyous day, not a cheerless day. A man who had worked hard the whole week long, it was said, could feel the pleasure that God himself had felt when the creation was finished. It was so obvious a fact of Jewish life that even the Romans were forced to recognize it. Work Sunday through Friday, take Saturdays off. The entire year was sanctified by feasts, starting with Rosh Hashanah, which starts the new year, in our fall, which ended up in late September or early October, and proceeds through Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Hanukkah, Purim, Passover, and others. There was not a single month that didn't have a religious feast of one kind or another. Also, it was usual to go on pilgrimages with groups of friends or relatives. There was continual singing and chanting of innumerable voices. They were to know and to sing the Psalms, especially Psalms 83 and Psalms 119 to 133. They were to be engraved on their hearts. Again, Henry Daniel Rupps. This is a characteristic of Jewish life, whose importance cannot be exaggerated. This communal praying of a whole nation together had a very strong tendency to promote unity and cohesion. The ragged day laborer, the hermit in his loincloth, the wealthy Alexandrian or Babylonian merchant in his fine linen, all felt that they were brothers during the days that they had spent in the courts of the temple. During the actual religious ceremonies, they stood there, shoulder to shoulder. Daniel Rupps further explains how all of this contributed to the value of work. All the teaching of the Holy Scriptures then, and all the rabbinical development of it, showed the necessity of work and the dignity of work. One has but to look into the Gospels to see how great a place the trades occupied in the Jewish world. The plowman and the sower, the cattle breeder, the lake fisherman, the carpenter and the mason, and a great many others continually appear. Jesus came from this class, and he speaks of those who belong to it as men he met every day and with whose lives he was perfectly familiar. And with that, we can assume that John, too, was impressed with the inherent dignity at work and was sufficiently learned in the Torah to know not only how to commit it to memory, but to read and write it and to know the history and background of all the major feasts. And we must assume that not only was he educated in the way of the law, but that he practiced it with his family in his daily life, going to the local synagogue at morning and night, reading from the scrolls, commenting on it, and dropping some fish or shekels to the poor on the threshold of the steps on his way out. Now, thanks to both history and archaeology, we know quite a bit about the work and life of a fisherman in ancient Galilee. And it shouldn't be terribly surprising to us, given that the craft of fishing, at least without such niceties as electronic fish finders, steel winches, and rubber buoys, is pretty much the same. You go to where the fish are, you trap them or hook them, you pull them into your boat or on shore, you clean them, you treat them, you sell them. And so the things that archaeologists have dug up at ancient fishing sites are what we'd expect they would dig up. Hooks, spears, weights for nets, what they found in the digs at the two Bethsaida sites, for example. You'd find these same things in any fishing village today. They used nets in a couple of different ways, and we've already seen Jesus talk about one of them. One way was to throw a net, a circular net up to 20 feet across, they say, over the surface of the water with weights at the edges with lines attached. Let it sink to the bottom and trap the fish from the top down. Then, when the net's fallen, you pull the lines from up above or from the shore, and with it, all the fish in the net along with it. Then you'd sort out what you caught. You'd keep the good fish, throw out the bad fish, just like Jesus said you'd do. Or, if you weren't terribly scrupulous, put the bad fish aside to be sold to those pagan buyers. The second way they would use nets was to use a couple of boats. And we saw that technique above when Jesus told Peter to go out into deeper water. One boat would drop a net vertically in the water to create a wall from another boat to another many yards out. As many as 400 yards out. That's a long way and a lot of net. And then the second boat would sweep in a semicircle back towards the first boat. The sweep would then, again, hopefully trap a large school of fish into the vertical nets, and they'd haul the nets up into their boats. The sweep would have to be continuous, or the fish would escape. And if the net started dragging on the bottom, you'd have to jump in, grab the net, and keep it moving inland. This is probably why Peter was stripped, ready to jump in when he was back to fishing on Lake Galilee after the resurrection. Now, think for a minute about the skill sets you'd need to do this right. And that's apart from knowing how to swim, which was assumed. I'm going to list 10 of them. First, you'd need to be a good leader to tell people what to do and what not to do. Somebody would have to be in charge for an operation like that to work. They'd need to communicate effectively and to command respect, not hatred or ridicule. Second, you'd need reliable followers who could take instruction and not second-guess everything the leader told them to do. Not everybody listens or can take orders from another. Those people would not work well here. They'd need to work well with others, as commercial fishermen even today will tell you. Third, you'd have to have a degree of courage. You'd be on open water, usually not smooth water, leaning overboard, pulling hard on lines or nets in deep water, where you could fall over and get tangled in weights and nets and drown, even if you could swim, which still wouldn't likely help you if your boat were to capsize, say at night during a storm. And yes, you'd be fishing at night when you needed to, so you could avoid the heat of the day. Yes, you'd have cause for fear, and you'd have to work in spite of fear or overcome it, which is exactly what courage is. Fourth, you'd have to be strong. You have lots of heavy, repetitive lifting to do, all the live long day and night. Put the boat here, drop the nets, go over there, pull up those nets, go back to where you were, pull up those nets there. over and over and over again. Think of the hands you'd have, the callus on them after even a few years of that work, a finger or two distorted from multiple dislocations, rotator cuff issues, maybe even a hook in the eye or nose once in a while. Workers' comp rates are pretty high for commercial fishermen today. They would have been high for them back then too, if they would have had them. Fifth, you'd have to be hardy. You'd have to be used to cold water splashing over you, getting you wet at night in the wind. You'd have the sun beating down on you in the day, which is, again, why a lot of fishermen worked at night or the tweens of the day. You'd have wind blasting at your head and ears, freezing one minute, roasting the next, and you'd probably always be hungry, like most fishermen are, except you'd have no cooler around for beer and snacks. Maybe you'd have some dried salty fish to munch on, with some flatbread that you'd be hard-pressed to keep from getting soggy. Not the most appetizing. Pickled sardines, anyone? And you'd need to cope with, well, stinking, rotten fish all the time. It was a dirty job. It still is. Fish guts everywhere. Birds squawking, flying all around. Flies and bugs everywhere. Not just on fish, but on you. You'd be swatting at them constantly. It'd be second nature to you, but not a second nature you'd like. Sixth, you'd need to be assertive against encroachers. There was a general law then, as there is now, don't encroach on the other fisherman's territory. There really was such a law. The Tosefta, a compilation of Jewish oral law from the late 2nd century, records it. A man may not lay out his fishing net or set up his boat in the area of another person. So, you know this would happen from time to time. When fishing is lean in some guy's area, the guys move to some other's area, especially when they're hauling it in. That's a big no-no. But they're bullies, and you can't be a weenie around them. So, yes, another probable character trait of a commercial fisherman is either A, a sense of toughness to keep bullies from evading your fishing grounds, or B, a doggone good diplomat who can succeed in turning someone away without ending in fisticuffs. And a third characteristic would also be handy, being a good fighter. And I'd say, as a general rule, you don't want to pick a fight with a commercial fisherman, then or now. Seventh, you'd need to keep looking for signs all around you. Signs for the weather, what the clouds are doing, what the wind is doing, what the birds are doing. If you see something that might be trouble, you'd need to act before the trouble happened. You couldn't just say, yeah, those whitecaps are getting nasty, but look at that huge school of fish below us. There's a difference between a careful fisherman and a careless fisherman. The latter usually don't live very long. You'd have to be disciplined. You'd have to be concerned about safety, especially if you're responsible for the lives of people working for you, or for your coworkers, or even, say, for your aging father in the boat with you. What grown son doesn't worry about whether his old man is still up to snuff, even though the old man is filled with confidence and years of experience? Mistakes happen, and the numbers catch up with you, even if you have years of experience. A good son would be right to worry about an aging father, no matter how seasoned, would work extra hard and take extra precautions. Eighth, you'd have to be resilient, accepting the problems beyond your control. You don't have control over bad weather, bad fishing, equipment breaking down. Just when you see that enormous school of fish, your nets break. The fish go away. You have to go on shore, drag your nets in, repair them with clumsy, difficult instruments that themselves will break, and maybe with supplies that have run out unexpectedly. The nets were made of flax, or hemp, or linen. You'd be good at knot tying, as seamen always are. You wouldn't like mending nets, but you'd have to do it, and especially when you could see those guys in the other boats out there just hauling it in, and you're stuck there on shore fixing 400 yards of bad net. Ha! You should have been here yesterday! Ninth, and related to resiliency, you'd have to have the virtue of patience. Extraordinary patience. Sometimes you catch fish, sometimes you don't. I know what it's like to need that patience, because I don't have it. And I'm always the guy who shows up and catches nothing. Dude, you should have been here yesterday. Plus, I'm greedy. I really, really want to catch the most fish possible and limit out. And of course, I never do. But I'm not a good fisherman either. These fishermen of Galilee were. They knew that sometimes they catch, sometimes they don't. And when they don't, they need to do something else. Change locations. Change the bait. Come back later. Start earlier. Whatever. But they need a high degree of resilience to do something different. They learn through good experience and bad experience that they need to do something different, something that might work, because whatever they're doing now isn't working. They need to adapt, to adjust, to experiment, to not just try the same thing over and over, which is one definition of insanity, doing the same failure over and over, expecting to get a different result. Fishermen are not insane, not if they're in the business of it. And future evangelists will need the same adaptability too. Give the Greeks logic. Give the Jews signs. That took some trial and error, as Paul will tell you. And here's the 10th attribute a commercial fisherman would have to have plying his trade on Lake Galilee. He'd have to have some business savvy. How much are you going to sell your catch for? Are you going to undersell your friends in the next boat or village next to you? What's your catch of the day? What of your catch are you going to set aside for salting and drying? How about packaging and shipping for local and long-distance distribution? Will you own your own shippers, or will you use middlemen? How much will you pay them? What about choice catches and deliveries to VIPs? Why, you might ask, would we think about that in relation to John? Well, dear listener, I'll hearken you back to Lecture 4 during our Trial of Jesus series, and recall that arresting detail we find in John's Gospel, Chapter 18, when we heard about the courtyard of the high priest on the night of Jesus' trial before the Sanhedrin, and when Peter was trying to get in through the gate to see what was going on. Remember, the servant girl at the gate let Peter in only because he had John to vouch for him, because it says John was, quote, known to the high priest. Not only did John seem to know the servant girl, but she knew that John had even higher up connections than she did. Now, how was it that a lowly guy like John would be known to the man who was among the richest, most famous figures in all of Palestine? Who would be able to buy large crates and barrels of the choicest catches from the beautiful Sea of Galilee? But of course, the high priest and his buyers. And just who would be the one selling to him? Well, a very enterprising fishing family. Might that be Zebedee? As noted from Gospel of Mark, Zebedee was in the boat with the hired men. Might Zebedee have sent his dearly beloved son or sons to be his special ambassadors, that is, his salesmen or even delivery boys, to the residence of the high priest, to ensure his good faith commercial business with such an august figure? A transaction, don't you forget, would be pretty good marketing prospects for old Zebedee, who no doubt would get to crow, you know, we sell directly to the high priest, only the finest, you know. Oh, see the eyebrows raised. Yes, yes, most impressive. Imagine what that might also do for international sales, which we know there were. Friends, Romans, countrymen, I'm here to present to you the finest of catches from the Sea of Galilee in our subject state of Palestine by the very tradesmen who supply even the chief priests in Jerusalem. Come, come, your denarii will be most welcome here. By the way, I'm not the only one to imagine that John was connected to the high priest because his father was successful in the fishing industry. Eric F.F. Bishop presents the case for plausibility about this, too, in a 1951 article in the Catholic Biblical Quarterly. And he wonders, did their syndicate, for instance, supply the high priestly family with fish and fresh and cured fish? They might have been in charge at times of caravans taking salted fish from Terekay, laded on mules or donkeys. More than probably, our Lord and the apostles took this fish trip when occasion offered, which would certainly be at feast times. So I think we should remove from our minds the notion that simple fishermen were behind the gospel story, that they were some toothless, smelly, ignorant fools who became Jesus' followers and who let other people write up documents in their names that ended up in the canon of Holy Scripture. True, they might not have been elite aristocrats. Few people were. But they weren't the kind of ignoramuses that many modern scholars like to think them to be either. In fact, let's sum up what we can reasonably assume we can know about your average enterprising commercial fishermen at the time of Jesus in Galilee. They needed to be leaders, followers, courageous, strong, hardy, flexible, organized, alert to signs, attentive to safety, and exceedingly patient. They'd have to be financially savvy, business-oriented, good marketers, and competent in trade and commerce. And if you're especially successful, you'd need to know not only about international trade, but the preferences and needs of even the high priest in Jerusalem and plenty of other wealthy patrons who would like to say that they too are getting the same fine fish as the high priest was getting. Dare say you'd also need to be multilingual, or at least be using translators regularly. Greek was the lingua franca. Would commercial fishermen be expected to know Greek? Well, it'd certainly help. Now, taking all these same skill sets into consideration, don't you think they'd make excellent skill sets for becoming evangelists of the good news? That a good evangelist would be someone who both leads others and who works well with others? Someone who is not afraid to say or do things, knowing the physical and emotional risks at stake? Someone who'd be adventuresome, capable of long, difficult journeys, physical labor, extended periods without food, water, or comforts? Someone who'd be perceptive of people, know what they liked, what they didn't like, inspired them, or repulsed them. Someone who could read the signs, anticipate problems or opportunities, and know what to do. Someone who could talk to people at all levels of society and manage finances as needed. Someone who, if he decided to buy into the enterprise, would buy in hook, line, and sinker, as it were, and would dedicate himself fully to it, despite all risks. Do you think, then, that Jesus knew what he was doing when he made sure that a full one-third of his apostles were commercial fishermen? And that's not counting Philip, who was probably one, too, if he was from Bethsaida, the house of the fishermen. If we throw in Nathanael, who was friends with Philip, then we'd be talking maybe half of the apostles were fishermen. As one anonymous church father observed, he rightly goes to fishing places when about to fish for fishermen. Now, I understand there are many virtues among carpenters, but Jesus seems to have gone outside his own trade group to recruit his first round of missionaries. I'm not aware of any carpenters who are among the 12. I'm not aware of any lawyers either, although some might make the case that Judas was one. That would be just a cheap shot. So, in conclusion here of this particular episode, let's try to sum up where we've come so far in our knowledge of what we can plausibly attribute to the Apostle John. With all due deference to Father Meyer, I'd like to say it's more than just next to nothing, and more than just about fishing. We talked about Galilee. John grew up there. He would have known the history of the region. He would have seen the beauty of the lake, its waters, its shoreline, its vistas, its climate, its biological life. He was a small town boy, growing up in a fishing village, which is probably a lot like a lot of fishing villages even are today, quaint in terms of size and beauty, rough and woolly in terms of people. And if we take Jesus' words for it at face value, well, worse than Sodom. John, we should presume, would have seen his share of sin around him and the need for people to repent of it. He knew these people. He was around them all the time. He was born into a fishing family, the second of two brothers, and with devout, observant Jewish parents. He went to the synagogue, perhaps daily, but at least weekly, with the Shema on his lips morning and evening from the time he could form words on his lips. He memorized the Torah. He could read from the scrolls. He looked forward to the day when he could wrap himself in his prayer shawl like his dad and older brother and turn towards Jerusalem and ask Yahweh for his daily bread, the forgiveness of sins, and the coming of the kingdom of God. He may have even read aloud to the congregation and have offered his own commentary on the reading. He looked forward to the coming of the Messiah and the deliverance of Israel with all his heart, his mind, and his soul, and he wondered when all those many prophecies of old would come true. He loved the Sabbath and all the customs that went with it. Yahweh had rested after seeing all that was good, and so would he. He loved the feasts. They reminded him of Yahweh's love towards him and his people. He'd watch his parents give generously to the poor and consider how he would follow their example. And because his father made a living by fishing, so did John. He was a fisherman, tough as nails, weather-beaten, courageous, smart about weather, boats, and equipment, and probably also knowledgeable about the commercial side of the industry, and plausibly knowledgeable about the marketing and sale and delivery of fish in Jerusalem and to the house of the high priest and other elites there. And maybe he knew some Greek. All of this, I think, is a lot to know, a lot to ponder. And it's all about John, the one who stayed there to watch his Lord and Master be crucified. Is that all about him? Oh no, lots more. We need to talk about the things he saw as an apostle, a special apostle whom Jesus had uniquely chosen, along with only Peter and James, to see with his own eyes. These experiences, no doubt, were especially formative of him too. And they allowed him to stand there at the foot of the cross and not start swinging hammers and yelling and screaming to have fire come down from heaven on everyone's heads. He could have done that. He'd been expected to do that. He'd been justified in doing that. And we can easily imagine him doing that in some action. But he didn't do that. He didn't even try to do that. And he doesn't even seem to have been tempted to do that. This is what I still want to ponder. Who was this guy? I hope you'll stay with me for the next episode, John the Apostle.
When love just seems so far away,
keep hauling, keep hauling.
The tide will flood your heart someday.
Keep hauling, boys.
When you're guiding stars in the cloudy sky,
keep hauling, keep hauling.
You'll find your way to the bright sunrise.
Keep hauling, boys. Keep hauling.